Welcome back to ClimateCast, everybody. I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner. One of the clearest effects of climate change is the measured increase we're seeing in extreme rainfall. The Midwest has seen a 37% increase in the heaviest downpours since 1958. It's really simple atmospheric physics. Our warmer atmosphere holds about 4 to 5% more water vapor. And more moisture means heavier rainfall. So how do city planners deal with these heavier 21st century rainfall events when our cities are really built for a 20th century climate? NPR climate reporter Elizabeth Dunbar joins me to look at some options. Hi, Elizabeth.
Good morning, Paul.
Hey, this sounds pretty cool to me. A little preview of your story coming up next week. Tell us what city planners are looking at to help minimize future floods.
Well, one of the things that they're doing is they're re-examining these century-old stormwater tunnels. And so I'm actually get to go inside one of these tunnels next week.
Cool.
Below the streets of downtown Minneapolis. I mean, I had to go through special safety training. I get to wear a hard hat, headlamp and stuff. So I'm pretty excited about it. But what they're doing is they're having to figure out, you know, how these tunnels can help through these heavier rains that we're having. And I mean, they're crumbling anyway. So it's like sort of adapting to the climate that we have now and trying to maintain these tunnel systems.
Do they have an idea, and I know you're doing this story next week, but how much capacity there might be to divert floodwaters?
So the short answer is there's not enough. And so the question is, you've got this built city, right? And you've got the stormwater tunnels. You can't really just make them bigger.
Right.
And so one of the things that they're doing is they're really pushing for green infrastructure. And that's the idea of making it possible for more stormwater to be absorbed on the landscape. So you'll see things like rain gardens. A lot of people see those along streets, green roofs, parking lots that have special pavement where the water can kind of seep through the pavement. So all of those things actually cost quite a bit less than building new tunnels and, you know, disrupting the streets and things like that.
Well, it also slows the water down, which, of course, can mitigate flooding. And I know that's something that hydrologists, my fellow sort of weather geeks, think about.
Right. So slowing down the water is one thing. But also, you know, when all of these stormwater tunnels were built 100 years ago, people didn't really care as much about water quality. And these heavier rains, you know, bringing all of this water off of a built city environment, there's a lot of pollutants that gets in that. And, you know, a lot of our lakes and rivers are polluted because of that.
So do we have an idea how much engineering would be required to turn these tunnels into stormwater drainage?
Well, I mean, they are, you know, the idea is to optimize them and to also figure out, okay, is there a way that we can minimize the amount of pollutants that go in there. And so they're doing a lot of modeling. So engineers are involved with that. But then it's also, like we said, just kind of maintaining it where it's crumbling, figuring out how to put that together so that it optimizes us for this 21st century climate that we have.
You talk to, you know, a lot of city folks in your reporting on your beat. How big of an issue is urban flooding becoming?
Well, it's a big issue. I went to the National Adaptation Forum this week. You're going to have some folks on. And city planners were among a big group of people who were attending this conference about how to adapt to climate change. I did talk to St. Paul Mayor Chris Coleman. He was one of the speakers at this Adaptation Forum. And one of the things he mentioned is that St. Paul has had 5 floods just in the last decade. And so this is a real concern for cities. There's actually a whole group of them along the Mississippi River that have, you know, pooled their resources and are working on this issue because Mississippi River towns and cities are seeing a lot of flooding, and the costs of dealing with the damages and the infrastructure and just maintaining the existing infrastructure are real for them.
Sure. Great content, great discussion. Elizabeth Dunbar, the climate change reporter for NPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
We'll be right back. Now we go in depth. Cities, as Elizabeth said, on the front lines of climate change.
This is really about the science, and this is really about finding solutions and creating pathways to achieving the goals outlined in Paris. Local governments absolutely have a role to play.
That's Edmonton Mayor Don Iveson talking about the 2018 Cities and Climate Change Science Conference in Edmonton next March. Cities and climate change, they're adapting to a 21st century climate with a 20th century infrastructure. How do they do that? That's the big question. This week at the 2017 National Adaptation Forum going on at the River Center right here in St. Paul. To help us answer that, we've got Carrie Mulliman with the City of Minneapolis Sustainability Program Coordinator and Varun Sivaram, Acting Director of the Program on Energy Security and Climate Change at the Council of Foreign Relations. Welcome to ClimateCast, you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Kelly, let's start with you from your session this week. I notice you say three climate trends, rising temperatures, extreme storms, and higher dew points, are driving the frequency and intensity of extreme weather in Minnesota. How can we assess vulnerability to increasing weather extremes, more weather volatility in Minnesota?
So there's a couple different ways, and I think the start is with our data. So we have the data that shows what the increasing trends are, and we know that the climate models are showing that these trends are going to continue and just get worse. Mm-hmm. So what we have to understand is where those impacts are going to touch the city at a local scale. What streets are going to flood? How can we manage that flooding? Where do we have the worst urban heat island impact across the city? And then who lives in those areas? Who are the vulnerable populations? There's a lot of research out there that tells us who the vulnerable populations are, but there's also a lot of local knowledge that we have to tap into
so
as well.
So you're really sort of breaking this down into the micro scale level on many fronts, right?
Absolutely. So we're taking it down to the street. And there's one of the challenges of the climate models right now is we don't have the spatial granularity that we really need to do planning.
Right.
So we're looking at a lot of historic data and what have been some of the 500 or 1,000 year storms that we've seen recently in Minnesota. What have those impacts been and how do we plan for more of them?
How much is climate change and extreme weather on the radar of city planners? Who's involved and are they taking the changes seriously?
It depends on the city that mm-hmm. you're talking about. In mm-hmm. Minneapolis, we are, very fortunate to have very progressive planners who are on top of a lot of these issues. As the city does its comprehensive plan update right now, we're talking about how to integrate climate adaptation, climate mitigation, clean energy, equity, all of those issues into our planning process.
Varun, why do cities seem to be so much on the front lines of climate change?
Well, taking a more global perspective here, cities really need to be doing this. The reason is there's probably an estimated $4 to $5 trillion financing gap for resiliency to the effects of climate change at the city level around the world. Cities are facing all the effects that Kelly just mentioned and many more. For example, Rio de Janeiro faces threats of epidemics. I used to work in the city of Los Angeles where we faced droughts. And that's all in addition to heat waves, the urban heat island that Kelly mentioned, storms, increased precipitation, sea level rise, and flooding. So cities really need to be on the front lines of this. There's an absolute, almost existential need for them to step up.
And do the effects of climate change become more amplified, I guess, in urban environments in some ways? More immediate, concentrated effects and feedback also from constituents. Do you see that also, Varun?
Yeah, that's a great point. So let me cite a couple effects that are accentuated in urban environments. So heat waves will occur as a result of climate change all over the world. But in cities, the heat effect will be concentrated because of the heat island effect. That means that when you have a lot of asphalt or dark roofs, you're going to absorb more heat from the sun in an urban rather than a non-urban environment. Similarly, in cases like New York, I used to work in the state of New York, New York City is an extremely built-up economic environment. And so you have so much economic exposure from your very expensive buildings and high economic activity that the same flood in New York City is going to cause billions more in damage than it would anywhere else. So those are two of the ways that you can have this intersection of urban accentuation along with climate impacts.
You're listening to ClimateCast on NPR News. I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner. We're talking about climate change and cities today. If you have some perspective or a question for our guest, feel free to jump in. 651-227-6000, the number to call, or you can call us toll-free at 800-242-2828. Kelly, you touched on this a little bit with some of your colleagues, maybe at this conference and around the country. How much attraction is climate change adaptation getting in cities around the country?
It's quite a bit these days. Minneapolis is part of the Urban Sustainability Directors Network, which is a network of directors of sustainability across the country. And there are working groups that talk about all the different issues that these folks are dealing with. And more of our subgroups have been talking about adaptation and preparedness. We've gotten to the point where we can't mitigate our way out of the issue. We're seeing the impacts. And so we have to come together as a group of professionals and figure out how we plan for this in our cities. With this National Adaptation Forum being hosted in St. Paul this year, it's the largest group they've had come together. The conference happens every 2 years, and this is the third time. It's been growing every time. There are nearly 1,000 people there talking about this issue and how we address it both in urban and rural areas.
You know, I've always said that famous phrase, follow the money, applies to climate change in many ways. Working with a city, what are the real costs that climate change is producing for cities and infrastructure?
So one of the things that you mentioned of the three vulnerabilities that we've really identified for Minneapolis, one being flooding, it has major costs to our infrastructure. Building streets, maintaining bridges, the buildings that we find protection in, those all have very significant costs. And anytime we have a major flood event, I mean, we saw this in Duluth in 2012, the pictures that everyone in Minnesota is familiar with, it's very, very serious impacts. And they have cascading impacts because perhaps basements flood and people don't have the resources to properly dry those out, so then they get mold, and then there's ultimately health impacts. Our state health department is looking at a lot of the health impacts of climate change, both in rural and urban areas of Minnesota.
Yeah, I talked to my insurance agent recently about coverage for my basement, and boy, it's a complicated thing, and the coverage isn't always what it needs to be. Varun, with risk comes opportunity. I like to talk about opportunities on ClimateCast. I've often said climate change mitigation and adaptation may be our generation's next economic moonshot. What are some of the economic opportunities for cities with climate change?
Well, let me talk about an opportunity in the state of New York that I used to work in. After Hurricane Sandy in 2012 caused tens of billions of dollars of damage, the state and the city of New York decided to try and improve its resiliency, particularly in its power sector, the electricity grid, because we had prolonged electricity outages after Sandy. And the solution that we've come up with in New York is not only to have a more resilient grid, but also a more decentralized grid that could bring these other benefits including affordability, because we have a more decentralized grid, a grid that relies on local rooftop solar panels, batteries, fuel cells that are less likely to be kicked off in a cascading blackout from a storm and more likely to keep the local hospital running. Well, so there's an affordability benefit, a clean energy benefit, and a resiliency benefit.
Yeah, and we know, of course, solar is booming across the country these days. Let's grab a call. Andrew in Minneapolis, good morning. Welcome to ClimateCast. What's your comment or question this morning?
Well, thanks for having me. I'm actually working on a climate change mitigation project called Seeds for Climate Change. Last summer, over the course of 18 months, I planted 500,000 trees.
All right.
Concept. Yeah. And I'm looking to do 100 million seeds in the next 30 years. In order to mitigate climate change, I've got a little Kickstarter going. I just got kind of published on that. But my proof of concept has been done in Two Harbors, Minnesota, over the course of the last 18 months or so. It's really simple. I mean, one of the best ways to get carbon sequestered is by planting young, dense forests. And I've seen a lot of research in that area as far as carbon sequestration goes. And the methodology is really simple. I just go around and collect seeds from ditches, roadsides, curbs, and I'm not joking. I got another 100,000 seeds that I've started in trays at my house this year.
Interesting.
It's so easy, and my price point is next to nothing, so I can guarantee a rate of one seed per quarter or one seedling per dollar that's kicked into the Kickstarter. And I'm also looking for bigger partners.
All right.
For corporate
Great.
Partnerships, that kind of thing.
Got it. Andrew, thank you. Very interesting perspective. And Kelly, trees in the urban environment, they're a thing that, like we talked about before, they also can slow down rainwater and mitigate flooding. How are you and your folks working with trees?
Yeah, so in our public works department, we have some very talented folks who are working on stormwater mitigation, and they see trees as one of the big solutions for that problem. Not only reducing the impact of rain and helping with infiltration, but also just managing the landscape, preventing as much runoff and soil erosion. So, related to that, with this caller's comments on seeds, mm-hmm. There's a big effort to promote pollinator-friendly planting as well.
Interesting. Let's grab another call, Jenna in Shoreview, originally from California, I understand. Good morning.
Hi. So, yes, I'm originally from California. Grew up being aware of smogging and that sort of process, mm-hmm. car registration. And I didn't actually know until very recently that Minnesota used to do smogging. And I don't know how long ago that was, first of all, but I'm wondering if what Minnesota's status is as far as how smog is affecting climate change, if it is, and if we would ever go back to that.
All right. Thanks for the question. I'm not sure any of our guests have the real expertise on that, but I think here's my crack at it. We used to have those programs in place, I believe, but I think if your vehicle's newer than a certain year, you don't have to do that anymore. So I'm not sure if it's been completely phased out. I'm thinking here, Varun, as we see, and you touched on this, the transition that we're seeing, sort of the solar energy boom and some of the job opportunities. You know, I saw recently wind energy technician is the fastest growing job in the United States. What other jobs could we see in the next 10 to 20 years from now that don't exist today as this sort of energy transition goes forward?
Yeah, and solar installer is also a tremendously quickly growing job category. So I think that both solar and wind are going to be big employers even as we go into the future, even if particular regulations passed under the Obama administration don't continue, like the Clean Power Plan. However, my biggest hope for job growth in the United States actually comes from advanced energy technologies, the next generation, for example, of solar energy, not the current generation. And that's why I strongly advocate investing in research, development, and demonstration. If we invest in innovation, we will create many more, for example, manufacturing jobs in the United States. Those are the kinds of jobs that we really want to be bringing home.
Kelly, at the conference this week, as you're talking to people, what's the vibe? You said the conference is bigger. Are cities getting support locally from residents? I mean, how do people think about climate change and cities?
Yeah, it really depends on the region that you're coming from. In Minneapolis, we can talk about climate change. In some other cities, they might not have the political support to actually say those words. Hmm. However, everyone is very concerned about the impacts. We're already seeing the impacts. And so we have to plan for and mitigate those impacts. And a lot of it has to do with the rising sea levels and coastal communities, storm surge, more hurricanes. So those are things that even more conservative communities can get behind and really plan for. The other thing that's the main trend or a bigger trend this year in the National Adaptation Forum is the conversation about climate equity and climate justice and really how the frontline communities are going to be impacted first, are being impacted first, mm-hmm. and will have more disproportionate impacts.
Varun, what's your perspective on that as you see cities and how they address climate change and, the varying level of support around the country and around the world for that matter?
It's a great question, a question of equity. In many cases, there are win-wins to be had as you both build up a more resilient infrastructure and you try and better serve the communities within the city. So, for example, You look at initiatives, for example, to modernize mass transit systems. Now, mass transit is super important in an emergency response situation. You need your mass transit to keep running. And one way to do that is to build in redundancy through, for example, multimodal mass transit. You could have a subway, you could have a bus system, etc. And if you design it right, you could actually increase the access for marginalized communities to be using that mass transit, both in non-emergency and emergency situations. All of this is to say, to build on a response that Kelly made earlier on, that previously, folks who worried about disaster response were kind of siloed off from folks who, for example, did transit planning or folks who did energy sector planning. Mm-hmm. But now everyone's got to do the same thing. We've all got to think about how do we design our critical infrastructure not only to serve marginalized communities, for example, but also to respond well in the case of a disaster.
You know, I can tell you this conversation has come a long way in the 4 years since we've started ClimateCast. The kind of conversations I'm having today on this show are very different than we did just 4 years ago. I'm honestly a little surprised at how quickly awareness and actionable, you know, science is being put into play at the city level and at many other levels. Let's grab another caller, Michael in Eden Prairie. Good morning. What's your question this morning?
Morning. I have a couple of points to make. First of all, I've lived in the Twin Cities 37 years in basically the same western southwestern sector of the metro.
I know it well.
And what I have noticed. And I'm kind of an amateur meteorologist. I'm also have a PhD in another field. But the echoes, what I often see is when precipitation events move toward the Twin Cities proper, a divergence where you get heavier precipitation, particularly to the south and southeast, and to the north and northeast. And I've often found that we get very little in the immediate southwest metro, unless the storm or the system is extremely strong.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been my observation. The other is...
Well, let's stop there for a second because that's something I can speak to. There's a couple of angles on that. One, is the urban heat island getting more intense is essentially what you're asking. And the studies show, yes, that is happening. The second part of that question is it affecting incoming weather systems, particularly summer, what we call convective thunderstorms? And the jury's a little bit out on that question. The most of the studies show that if the storm's big enough, as you mentioned, the heat island really doesn't have much of effect. The other thing is sort of perception, Michael, that everybody I talk to in weather thinks, oh, it always rains somewhere else. The storms always miss us. So there might be a little bit of both of those things going on there.
Sure.
And what's your second point, real quick?
Well, what we've noticed, my wife and I are gardeners, and we've been able to successfully plant a redbud tree in our backyard, which was a zone 4 tree found commonly on the lee side of Lake Michigan in southwest Michigan. And we've been able now to establish trees in our zone that probably 25 years ago would have been unheard of. It's the rapidity of this change that I find remarkable.
Yeah. Great question. Great points. Thank you, Michael. Kelly, microclimate changes in the Twin Cities. You're trying to scale this down to the street level. What have we observed so far that stands out to you?
Yeah, well, you mentioned already the urban heat island effect and the growth of that. We have data from the University of Minnesota that shows that Minneapolis is really the core of the urban heat island in the Twin Cities metro. And on a hot day, during a heat event, the hottest hour of the day, Minneapolis may be 9 degrees warmer than some of the surrounding rural areas. That has a really big impact on the health of our residents. There's a lot of things that, you know, that we can do for that, planting additional urban tree canopy, partnering with our Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board that manage a lot of the street trees.
Mm-hmm.
And they're looking at an ecosystem study right now to understand, to the caller's question, a little bit better about the changes in the biomes and where the plant hardiness zones are advancing.
Sure. And I know that the heat island even effect can be even more intense at night and in the early morning and in the winter months, which is also an interesting phenomenon. Varun, what's your perspective on urban heat island, the changes we're seeing not only here in the Midwest, but other parts of the world?
You know, we saw an even more pronounced heat island effect in the city of Los Angeles. And one of the initiatives I got to work on was a cool roofs initiative. If you paint your roofs white and if you try and increase the low albedo coverings on streets, for example, you can reduce the urban heat island effect and reduce that temperature difference between the urban environment and the surrounding environments. So that's one of the steps that cities can and should be taking around the country.
And I'm interested in your experience in Los Angeles. Having lived in Arizona for so many years, the difference between Tucson and Phoenix is amazing in terms of xeriscaping and, heat island-friendly plants and roofs. Phoenix is lawn central, although that's changing. I know that pressure is growing in Los Angeles, isn't it?
It absolutely is growing. Awareness is growing, and frankly, temperatures are rising. So Los Angeles is going to have to deal with it sooner rather than later, preferably sooner.
We're listening to ClimateCast here this morning on Minnesota Public Radio News. We're talking about cities and the way that they're dealing with climate change. Let's look ahead a little bit, you guys. Kelly Mulliman with the City of Minneapolis is with us. Varun Sivaram also with the Council on Foreign Relations. Let's think ahead. 50 years. How different will our cities look because of climate change, Kelly?
That is a big question to ask. And I don't know that I've thought 50 years out yet. Minneapolis has an opportunity starting now to be part of the 100 Resilient Cities Initiative through Rockefeller. We'll be hiring a chief resiliency officer shortly. And their job will be to develop a resilience plan for Minneapolis and really think out a little bit farther in a more integrated way with all of our different departments on how do we become a resilient city. So what that looks like in the future, some of that visioning is yet to happen. We want to bring in community members to really develop that vision and the strategies with city government. They have a lot of local on-the-ground knowledge that can be tapped, as well as, you know, the changes in our demographics will have a huge impact on that as well. Being a sanctuary city in Minneapolis, as well as St. Paul, welcoming in more immigrants and refugees, and the knowledge that they will be bringing with them as being some of them climate refugees themselves and how they've adapted to their changing climates.
Varun, what do you think as we go forward? How do our cities look different half a century from now because of climate change?
You know, Kelly, I'm really glad you brought up the 100 Resilient Cities Initiative by the Rockefeller Foundation. That is a terrific initiative, and it's caused some cities to make the 10% pledge, to pledge 10% of their annual budget to resilience every single year. If they do that, they will be able to design cities that are, in fact, much more adaptable to climate change. This could be Bangkok flood-proofing its city from its Chao Phraya River. It could be Copenhagen, which is already developed many green measures rather than gray infrastructure measures. We heard about this earlier, creating parks to direct the flow of water rather than bigger pipes. But the flip side is if we don't invest in resilience, we could see tremendous costs. So look at 2050, several decades out, a Sandy-like event in New York City would cause $90 billion in economic damage because of the greater economic exposure and because of sea level rise from climate change. So there's a stark choice that cities face.
Varun, as we look at other parts of the world, are we behind in the U.S. on the way we're adapting to climate change?
You know, in some ways we are. Some cities, you know, you look at Rotterdam, for example, have much more experience adapting and being inventive with the ways that they adapt to, for example, flood risks. And other cities, especially in the developing world, are going to feel the brunt of climate change. There will be flooding in Bangladesh. There may be disease outbreaks across South America. And so, you know, in some sense, those cities really have their work cut out for them. The United States cannot afford to be complacent. We will have our share of impacts at home, whether in the Gulf Coast, for example, in Florida. And we absolutely need to be preparing now, and we need to be learning from other cities. This isn't a competition. Everybody's in this together.
Great discussion today. You too, Kelly Mulliman with the City of Minneapolis, and Varun Sivaram with the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.